From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we examine the rise of right-wing populist movements in Europe and how they compare to current politics in the United States.
Later, an 86-year-old Grafton man shares the chilling story of the day the Germans marched into town before World War II.
Grafton was quite notorious for that very reason. And whether that's good or bad, I don't know, but it's one of the things that we're known for. Whether we want to be known for it or not, it's history, so.
We'll stop by a historic building and a Milwaukee workspace that seeks to connect startup entrepreneurs across a wide spectrum.
They called it the Amazon of the 1800s, so it's old, and there are still some artifacts, we like to call them, around the building from the hardware companies, and so we still have a lot of that old Milwaukee in the building when we also have this innovative space, so it's really cool.
Plus a performance by singer-songwriter Glenn Phillips. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Nationalist political parties are on the rise in Europe. While the party platform specifics differ between countries, these radical right-wing populist movements tend to be anti-immigration and anti-European Union. They also favor economic protectionism.
Unlike broader political movements like fascism or socialism, populism on either side of the political spectrum essentially says those in power don't have our best interests at heart, so we need to get rid of them. Kick the bums out. The problem is very often little thought is given to what to replace the bums with.
Irene Braum is the executive director of the Bertelsmann Foundation, which is based in Washington, D.C. The nonpartisan think tank offers a transatlantic perspective on global issues, including the rise of right-wing populism in Europe. She joins us in the studio now. Irene Braum, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for inviting me.
In the past few years, we've seen the rise of political parties like UKIP in England, the National Front in France, the People's Union in Germany. There are many others. And they and other right-wing populist parties across Europe seem to be flourishing. And I guess the first question to you is why? Why is this phenomenon happening?
Well, I think, first of all, you said it rightly. I think in Europe we have seen populist parties for many years now. And they are on the rise for different reasons, because every country in Europe is facing different difficulties. I think if you kind of look across the line, a lot of people, and that is also if you look at the surveys, fear uncontrolled migration. I think in addition, there's a fear of Islam. And also, people feel that they are kind of being left behind because of the globalization, people losing their jobs because of the digitization, and see a decrease in income and a rising inequality.
So what do the populist parties offer the citizens of their country who are voting for them? What do they promise that can change in the face of that globalization?
Well, they promise very simple things, but which are often very difficult to implement. If you look at the populist party in the Netherlands, he basically promises the people to stop uncontrolled immigration, but also basically to throw out a lot of people who have entered the Netherlands on as a refugee in the last few years. In France as well, you know, Marine Le Pen is promising people that, first of all, they would leave the European Union because they think, like Mr. Trump in the U.S., that they can make better deals, trade deals, if they're out of Europe. So it's often very simple solutions, but then if you dig a little bit deeper, they will be just incredibly difficult to realize.
Great Britain actually did it. They voted to leave. Brexit is happening, and there's supposedly a timeline when that's going to happen. And do you think that that was fueled also by fear of immigration and of economic issues?
Well, I think there's several issues. They played it very hard on anti-Europe. And, you know, why can we not decide on a lot of issues ourselves anymore? But the decision is being taken in Brussels. There was a fear of migration, but coming from the European Union, within the European Union. So there were a lot of people from the Eastern European countries which have moved to the UK. And I think that has kind of created a backlash against migration. So there again, it is very different. But if you look at the numbers, only 38% of the people voted to leave. A lot of people didn't even go to vote. And I think a lot of people only realized later that, you know, the Brexit, the leavers had won the campaign.
The people who are the heads of these populists, and these are right-wing populist parties. We're not talking about left-wing in this case, because I know there's different kinds of populism across the world, but these are particularly hardline right-wing groups. If they are offering simple solutions that are very difficult to actually implement, promises that may not be able to be kept, what happens if they get into power? I mean, what happens to the people who voted and then are let down by these parties?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. There are already some right-wing populist leaders in charge in some of the Eastern European countries. And if you look in Slovakia, they had for a few years a right-wing populist. And he didn't deliver what he promised. And then also because he came into power, that reunited all the others and they kind of formed a bloc. So in the next elections, he was basically voted out. So maybe people wake up. I think for us, if I look at the Netherlands, Germany and France, because that are the three countries where we have upcoming elections this year, let's take the first one, the Netherlands. If Geert Wilders wins and he is able to form a government, because you always need several parties in the Netherlands to form a government. He has basically, although he has been member of the parliament for many years, he doesn't really have an entourage which is used in legislating. So I think it will have a backlash. If they then don't deliver the next election cycle, they will be out.
So what happens, though? What kind of damage can they do if they do get in? What kinds of things do you fear would happen if too many of these populist leaders take power?
Well, I think looking at the Eastern European countries, fear is definitely a limitation of freedom of the press. And you already see it happening in the Eastern European countries. If I look at France, a real fear is a referendum on the European Union, and will we have a Frexit after the Brexit? And that would potentially lead to the end of the European Union, because France is now the sole big military power within the European Union. Now the UK is leaving. So what will be left? Germany is not a military power within the
European
Union.
Not in the same way, no.
Not in the same way, no.
What is it about these kinds of movements? I mean, on the surface, populism sounds like a good thing. It sounds like people uniting to say, you know, this government isn't serving us. We need to take matters into our own hands. It's kind of what the United States was founded on, the idea that we should have say over our future. But these seem to not be quite so positive. And so what happens, do you think? Where does the change happen from this is a good idea that people want to be involved in their own futures to the kind of right-wing parties that we're seeing and platforms that we're seeing?
Yeah, I think these right-wing platforms, I think they operate in a very clever way. First of all, they're already reaching out directly to the population. And if you take the different right-wing or populist movements in Europe, they act a little bit the same as Trump does in the U.S. You know, they use social media a lot. They use the social media a lot to target their voters' base. So the voters now already think or are under the impression someone is listening to me because I have this, they believe this direct communication. I think, of course, in the end, it will reveal that it's much more difficult once you're really governing a country. And so they are using, they're kind of fueling the anti-political establishment sentiment even more. Similar like in the US, this hate against the mainstream media. So they are, I think they have in a way a very clever strategy. And again, you know, Marine Le Pen, She's not a new kid on the block. She did this for many years. It's a very well prepared campaign. Geert Wilders in the Netherlands as well. He's one of the most oldest member of the parliament in the Netherlands. So they know how to play the voters base very, very well. I'm not sure whether they afterwards also know how to keep satisfying their voters base, and because they have to collaborate with other political forces, unless, you know, they win with such a big majority, but it doesn't seem that Marine Le Pen will have kind of 60% of the voters, or Geert Wilders will have 67 seats in the parliament.
And that is something that is different, certainly, than the way we govern here. You're talking about a parliamentary system where collaboration is kind of built in to the system. And our system here is much more opposites, two opposites fighting, or it seems that that's the way it is. Do you think that because of the very nature of the parliamentary system, there's less danger from these kinds of populist movements?
Yeah, there's less. It will take them a longer time to basically get there where they want. Take the example of the AfD in Germany. I think the latest polls, they polled 12%. Their first aim now is getting seats in the national parliament. So at federal level.
And how many
level,
do they need? 15% or?
The threshold is 15%. So I think they will probably, you know, win some seats. And they see that as a first step. So it's a very, very long way. And then there are other what we call kind of forces which might block them. But still, I think the fact that they are running, that they are extremely popular, is really not a good sign.
You mentioned, of course, the elections here and President Trump. Did you in Europe see that happening here? What was the viewpoint as the election was upcoming and the fact that he did win on a populist platform?
I think people didn't see it coming. But then also in Europe, a lot of people didn't see Brexit coming. I think if you would talk to the people like a year and a half ago, and you would say Donald Trump is running for president, they would all laugh and say, you know, this is a joke. Before the primaries start, he will be out. So I think it was kind of a wake-up call. People react in a way like, oh, what is happening now? The world is changing. And the Europeans often forget that we already have also a lot of populism in Europe, and that is not something which is new. So they were quite shocked. They are worried because also he does not give the impression that he appreciates the transatlantic relations like previous presidents did. So I think it also goes much further than maybe the U.S. having a populist president, but also what does it mean for the Western order?
Do you think that the fact that Trump was elected has emboldened?
Yes. It has definitely emboldened Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, and it has emboldened Marine Le Pen. Although in France, the people are very anti-American, and a lot of people don't, even Marine Le Pen voters, don't like Mr. Trump. In Germany, it has had the opposite effect, and the AfD has gone down in the polls because of President Trump. So that is, it's very curious. There are different effects on the outcome of the elections here in the United States.
Do you think that this tendency, it seems to be a very human tendency to circle our wagons, you know, we all are tribal in some way or other. Do you think this is cyclical? Are we in a time where somehow everybody seems to want to retract as opposed to reach out across the pond or across the world?
Yeah, the world has become more accessible. And so in a way, everybody's personal world has become much larger, much bigger. And I think then people have a tendency is in kind of having their own safe space. There was recently a study which was published in the Netherlands where they basically asked the people, so what is your fear? What is your fear of this globalization? And a majority replied, we fear the loss of our identity. So I think, yes, people that is something which people are scared of.
What do you think is the answer to that? How do people who don't believe in populism and who do think that everyone has a place at the table, how do they fight that very human fear of losing who they are?
Well, there is apparently a real disconnect in between the people who rule the country and the citizens. So I think there needs to be a real reflection. How do you kind of stimulate this interaction? How do you give also the people who do not live in a big city, give them the impression that they are heard, that their concerns are heard? That is very important, how you do it. I mean, we are at the Bertelsmann Foundation, we are looking into maybe how can you use also these digital technologies in bringing the citizens closer to those who govern the countries and those who decide on legislation and make them more participate in a legislative process. And that doesn't mean that everything needs to be made subject to a referendum. I think, you know, that would be kind of, it's impossible to do. But I think there the politicians really need to reflect, you know, how can we also give those who believe that they are the forgotten ones. And that is not only, you know, we have seen that in the U.S., but in Europe as well. That is what people say. They forgot about us. You know, jobs have gone because robots came in. And people don't basically care what is happening to us.
It sounds to me, and it's very much like what happened here as well. Jobs have gone, and it's not because necessarily they went overseas, but because the technology's changed. And those particular jobs are not going to come back because those jobs no longer exist. Not because we don't care about you, but because they simply have changed. With the kind of work that your foundation is doing and other foundations like yours, how do you see making that communication happen, you know, with citizens and their governments and across governments and citizens? You know, I think that's important, too. It's not just within one country, but it's within the entire world.
Yeah. Maybe you should also have a much more local approach to certain problems, like more bottom up than top down. We strongly believe that because people are losing their jobs because of automation, and that will only be worse, you know, there are also a lot of jobs which are currently not affected, which will be affected in the next 10 years. So you need to have a plan, and either you kind of prepare the people and the workforce that they will not have, no longer have these traditional jobs, but maybe two or three jobs. But also you need to adapt the educational system and skill the people and give them the skills they need. What we see in the Netherlands is that the fear of globalization, people have lost their jobs, but then there are still a lot of jobs which are unfilled. So there is a level of unemployment, but there's also a lot of jobs which are for offer, which have a lot of difficulties in finding the right skilled people.
So it's training and education
as
well.
Yeah, training and education as well. And that takes time, and maybe also stimulating people and being more mobile and moving from one side to the country to the other. Well, in the Netherlands, that's not difficult because it's very small. But if you go to Germany or to France, you know, these are bigger countries. So how do you move then also people and make them mobile?
It doesn't seem like there's any easy answer to this.
No. Unfortunately not.
I want to thank you so much for taking a few moments to talk with us about it. I know we just scratched the surface, but Irene Brahm, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Irene Brahm is the executive director of the Bertelsmann Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. The organization offers a transatlantic perspective on global challenges. Brahm was in Milwaukee recently to speak about populism at UWM's Institute of World Affairs.
We'll speak with a witness to a little-known chapter of history in southeastern Wisconsin, the presence of a German nationalist camp in 1941 Grafton. That comes your way when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we talked about the rise of nationalist and populist movements around the world. It was the late 1930s when the rise of nationalism in Germany gave rise to Adolf Hitler, the Nazi Party, and the so-called Third Reich.
That nationalist movement was not limited to Europe, however. It was supported by German immigrants and others of German descent around the world, including here in the United States. In fact, southeastern Wisconsin was home to two camps run by a group of Nazi sympathizers called the German-American Bund.
Grafton was a town of little more than 1,000 residents and was where the Bund's Camp Hindenburg was located. There are few people alive today who were there the day the Bund came to town, and it's a history few in the community still talk about. But it is a day Skip Earnessy has not forgotten. He was 11 years old in 1941. We met him and the Grafton Historical Society's Nick Shannon in the Grafton Public Library, and Earnessy described what he saw.
Well, the thing I remember is that these Germans came marching up the street, and they had the German flags flying, and they were singing Deutschland, liebe alles, I think. And they were heading for the Grafton Hotel, where they usually held their meetings on Sundays. And because they had the German flags flying and their uniforms on us, it just so happened I was downtown at the time. A couple of us kids were down there, and we saw this, and we only had one police officer in Grafton at that time in 1941, and somehow the word got out that they were down there, the Germans, and quite a few people from the village were down there, too. And I don't know where they came from. I would almost assume they came out of Milwaukee, because there must have been at least 10 policemen all of a sudden there, and I don't know where they came from, but they made them take those German flags down, and they gave them an American flag, and they told them to get back to their camp, which was on the east side of the river at that time. And so they turned around, and they started walking up 12th Avenue here, right? Yeah, well, anyways, they came marching up this street right here past the where the library is now. Right there is where they threw the American flags down, and they put up their German flags again, and then they were singing their song and the rest of the way down to their camp, down to the river. And it was quite an exciting time for Grafton, you know, because we were a big village of about 1,100 people, which there's that many living on my block now, I think, the way the village is growing.
Well, and you were 11 years old. I imagine you kind of understood what's going on, but at the same time, this kind of thing doesn't happen in Grafton every day, even today.
Well, that's what I mean. It was really something, you know, something to see, and that's why that's why I remember it too, because it certainly was. I didn't realize it at the time, of course, that it was quite a historical situation there.
Do you remember what, I don't know, your parents or the adults that you knew at that time thought of what was going on?
Well, I remember we were eating dinner on December 7th, when all of a sudden on the radio they announced that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor and we were now at war. I really understood it after it got going, because, you know, being the size village we were, when the draft came on, well, they pretty much cleaned the town out of young guys. And my dad was a superintendent at Younger Stove and Range Company, which is an old company. And they had a government contract shortly after that for making parts for something, I don't know what it was, but in the foundry, because they had a gray iron foundry. And my dad had me working there in the summertime, and what always got me was I never could tell anybody how much I earned, because that was against the child labor laws or something, and my dad got paid in cash for me, and I got $5 a week, so I was the richest kid in Grafton.
You know, you talk about the Germans marching into town, but they had kind of, I mean, they had an ongoing summer camp here. What was the I guess atmosphere like between, you know, the kids like you who lived here and the people who came up, the, you know, some of the kids who were up in town for that?
Well, that camp did split up. The camp on the east side of the river was on Jim Wigner's farm, and it was called the Carl Schurz German-American Camp, if I remember correctly. In fact, I think that camp or that organization is still someplace west of here. They told me on some lake or someplace. But the Bund, the Germans, the radicals, they moved out, and they moved to the west side of the river on the Grafton side. and that's what's River Park now. I do remember that because on the Carl Schurz side, every summer, they were German kids, but I mean, they were all out of Milwaukee. Those were all German families, and that was their place that for summer camp. And they built a long barracks there, and the kids would be there, and because they put a fence up in the middle of the dam, and that was our swimming hole when we were kids down here at Limekill Park. And they put a fence up in the middle of the dam and said that this was our side, that was their side, we should stay on our side, which didn't work. You know, you can't tell kids like us that. That's why I said I was the first German prisoner of war.
Well, tell us that story. How did that happen?
Well, like I said, they told us to stay on our side of the fence. Well, one Sunday morning, Joe, my buddy, and I were down there swimming, and we didn't give a dang about that. So we were on the wrong side of the fence, and a couple of Germans came and grabbed us because we were on the wrong side of the fence. And we found out that Saturday, this was on Sunday morning, Saturday they had a big picnic there. And they gave us a stick with a nail in it and two Germans, one behind each of us. And they marched us through the park and we had to pick up all the papers and put it in bags. And we finally got out of there. And when I got home, it was Sunday. And I got home about 1:30, 1:45 in the afternoon. That's when we finally got out of there. And my dad, he laid into me. He says, you know, on Sundays, we eat dinner here at noon. I said, hey, Dad, the Germans wouldn't let us out of the camp. I said, we had to clean it up. You what? You know, he's hollered at me. He said, he was going to take care of that. Well, I don't know whatever happened about it, but I know he didn't. But that's why we said we were the first German prisoners of war. So, but they did split. And like I said, the Bund came on the east side of the river, and the German Americans stayed with their picnic grounds over the other side. And I gave them all that information as to who owned the land and who sold it and all that. Well, that's all in there. You know, all the paperwork. Well, Nick knows that too, yeah. So they got a pretty good history that I had obtained there from, Paul Knauer, his name was. And he lived down in the park down there. And he gave me all that information, and he died shortly after that too. So I was kind of glad he gave it to me.
Let me ask you this, Nick. How much do you think the people of Grafton today recognize about this period in the town's history?
Well, I don't think that the older people know all about the history of the Bund Camp in Grafton and what took place, especially shop owners. A very good local historian would have been Leroy Paulin, who owned Paulin's Market. So now there hasn't been so much talk about it. It's just been one of those things that it still is an active organization with private membership, but they don't talk about the past at all.
This does not hold the same place in Grafton history that the music industry did, for example.
Not one bit. We're very proud of the record factory here, made records, and you know, Grafton back then, we had all of the blues singers near Black come up from Milwaukee, down south, and everything was fine with that. But they were treated pretty good from what I understand, but not so much with the Bund Camp, especially as time kept progressing and things kept getting a little worse.
See, the problem with that question that you just asked is right now I can probably count on one hand the people that were born and raised in Grafton, old people. There's a lot of old people here, but they all moved in here because of the nice community and the facilities for them, and so they know nothing about this, you know. Anything that they probably read, they would know, but if you ask them a question about it, they say, Bund, what is that, you know.
Nick, your mom, if I remember correctly, you said your mother was born and raised here as well?
Yes, she was, and she grew up on 9th Avenue in Grafton.
Did she ever talk about this period?
She talked about knowing of it, but her parents were very protective of the kids. They would not, and being that they had five girls and only one boy, you know, they had to keep them at home. They would not let them run the town like Skip probably had free run of the town. Boys were different back then.
Let me ask you this, Nick. As someone who, you know, works to preserve history, do you think it's important to tell this particular story of Grafton's history? Do you think it fits some purpose for maybe kids today growing up knowing about this kind of darker period?
Well, being a local historian here, I believe it is good to record all history, whether, you know, because Grafton went from the lake all the way over to Cedarburg, from Port down to Mequon, and our history was Yulyul Station, Port Yulyul. You need to preserve that, and as long as you're telling the truth about the history, it should be kept and made of record. And if some people don't like that, well, this is the way it was. This is what honestly did take place. And that's why we are always trying to interview older people and get their thoughts on what it was like growing up in Grafton.
You know, even considering that period, was Grafton a good place to grow up? I mean, obviously you stayed.
Oh, I think so, yes. In fact, I miss the small community. We're a pretty good-sized community now, as you know. I mean, it's growing by leaps and bounds, and I think it's growing way too fast. But after the war was over, and all the guys were back from the service and everything, Seth Liebenstein lived next door to me, and he was in the Marines during the war, and he was over in the Philippines. And they were being bombed one day, and he said he dove into a foxhole. And I forget where he said the guy that was the other Marine that was in there, but they got talking to each other, trying to calm themselves down, he said. And this Marine asked Seth, you know, where are you from? And he said, I live in Grafton, Wisconsin. He says, hey, that's where the Bund is, isn't it? So apparently Grafton was quite notorious for that very reason. And whether that's good or bad, I don't know, but it's one of the things that we're known for. Whether we want to be known for it or not, it's history. So that shows you how far the word was around even during the war.
Yes, and during the wartime, there was a lot of support by all of the manufacturing in Grafton here. I know on both sides of my family, there was everybody was in the service. My ma did not go, and neither did one of her sisters, but they worked at a place on the east side of the river, north of the Highway 60 bridge. It was called Zones, and they made submachine gun parts during the war, and so that was their effort. And then she did have another sister, two sisters, one was a Wave and one was a Whack, and then my dad and three of his brothers were all in the Army. But everybody was making something for the war effort.
It sounds like even you.
Yeah, they were making parts for the what the parts were for. I don't know, but I did learn something there, though. I knew that I was never ever going to work in a foundry again, because at that time I was shifting weights, and that core gas was enough. I said I'd rob banks or do anything, but I'm not going back in a foundry.
And my dad, who worked at Grobe Incorporated down here, at that time it was Grobe Brothers when they started off right by the railroad tracks here in town. He worked there 44 years, and he remembered, and he told me this, that there was one German man from the Bund camp that would walk up, and because it wasn't that far of a walk, maybe a mile, and work at Grobe, and he was kind of kept to himself, eating lunch and that, and then he'd go back. And so that was one guy that was there and was employed, did good work at Grobe, but just didn't associate with too many other people. And like with my ma, being a girl in the family, all the girls, their mother and father were very protective. As soon as they got wind that the people from the Bund were up in town, everybody kind of gathered their kids in a little bit, because you did not know what's going to happen next.
It sounds like in the end it was still peaceful, but
yes.
That wasn't a given.
Yeah, it was peaceful, but you did not know. So to be on the safe side, they were very protective.
As someone who works to preserve history, it has to be important that there are still guys like Skip out there who remember this time.
Oh, I am so glad that I was able to hook up with Skip, because when John from the library here called me and said BBC would like to do something on bone camps in America, well, you know, nobody wants to cause anybody trouble. We just want to preserve history. And John checked with me, and I thought, oh, Skip is the first one that comes to my mind. I mean, there are many, but they're all passed already. But Skip, and he has a very good mind, he's very sharp, and he lived that time period at a good age when things were memorable. So I'm grateful for Skip, and I wish that there could be a few more. I do have one other name that I'm trying to get who actually owned the cottage down there afterwards, but she's not doing well right now.
Well, Skip, we're grateful you're here too, and that you're able to share these stories with us.
Well, I'm kind of happy about it myself, really. I never really gave that a thought as far as the history of Grafton, and being a part of it was, I guess, a privilege for me to be able to still be here on this earth, you know. Yes. And thank God that the adage of only the good die young, otherwise I'd be a long time gone already.
Well, Skip, Nick, thank you both so much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mitch.
86-year-old Skip Urnessy is a lifelong resident of Grafton and was 11 years old on the day that the German-American Bund marched into the center of town. Nick Shannon is with the Grafton Historical Society. We spoke with them at the USS Liberty Memorial Public Library in Grafton. You can find a link to more about the phenomenon of German Bund camps at WUWM.com.
Another quick break now, and then we'll pay a visit to Ward 4, which this week is working especially to connect women working in startup companies. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Making your way as a newcomer in the business world can be hard enough, but for people working in startup businesses, especially without a lot of business experience behind them, the challenges can be daunting. Add to that the challenges many women still face in the workplace, and you might imagine that the landscape is even tougher.
But this week, the Milwaukee co-working space called Ward 4 is aiming to work specifically with women entrepreneurs. Kenzie Enright's title is Ward 4 Community Curator, and we visited her at Ward 4 in the Pritzlaff Building in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for having us here.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so let's start with the beginning. Where are we right now? What is Ward 4?
So Ward 4 is a co-working space right in between Milwaukee's 3rd and 5th wards, so it seemed only right to label it Ward 4. So actually, shortly after Chris Abley founded CSA Partners, he started to explore startups and kind of the industry and the world of startups. So he noticed all these startups were housed in tech hubs and incubators, where there were words like energy and collaboration, and Chicago has like 1871, Minneapolis has COCO, WeWork is all over the place now. And he noticed we really don't have that in Milwaukee. So with that, he kind of really just discovered a need in Milwaukee for that kind of tech hub, one that would really foster that creativity and really nurture that collaboration and encourage that in the community and encourage growth of the startup industry and Milwaukee's community as a whole.
Right. Let me cut you off there. I mean, talk a little bit more about what co-working represents in that dynamic. Why is it important for people from startups that might not, on their surface, have anything to do with each other to be within close proximity to each other?
Yeah. So I got the first taste of co-working my first day here when I was trying to do the Ward 4 website. And I was sitting out there and I was pretty much pulling my hair out, frustrated. I can't even, like, handle when iTunes updates. I'm not really good with that kind of stuff. So someone walked over to me who has a graphic design background, and she said, "Can I help you?" So she sat with me for 45 minutes and did everything that I had been working on for 5 hours. And that was when I was like, okay, I get it. It's really collaboration focused. We are actually helping each other. And I think a lot of startups have people that are really good at one thing, like really, really great at one skill, but someone with a development background doesn't necessarily have a great like sales background. And so in the community here, we have people with all these kinds of skills that we can kind of work on, and it's really helpful to startups and to Milwaukee to build on that. It's really, I mean, it's growing the startup community.
You actually came to Ward 4 before you were actually working for Ward 4, right?
I was. I started at Bright Cellars. So by some work of magic, I actually just was matched with Bright Cellars through an intern match and came and had my interview and then ended up being the first intern they hired in Milwaukee, which was insane. I was here when there weren't even like doors or windows, and it was really cool.
And for people who don't know what Bright Cellars is.
Yeah, so it's a subscription wine company. But the two founders, so Joe Lorendi and Richard Yao, they actually were at MIT and took, I think it was some kind of wine class and found out this is a really cool thing. We want to do more with this. And Joe was a TA at with an algorithms class. So they decided to make a company of it, and it's grown so insanely much. I mean, I was the fifth person here in Milwaukee at Ward 4, and now they have, I believe, at least 30 employees.
Well, and talk about, and someday we're gonna take a little audio tour of this place, but talk about the significance of this space that we're in, not necessarily your office in particular, but you know, this does not look like a typical office environment.
No, not at all. And I actually I have friends who come in from out of town and say, like, this exists in Milwaukee. It's really cool to have that. But yeah, I think it's open. It's an open co-working space. We have some private offices, but also those offices have windows as doors because we still want to keep that energy and that focus on collaboration going. We have an event space that's huge. It's really industrial, and it's really conducive to that feeling that we're wanting to make an entrepreneurial ecosystem in Milwaukee.
Well, and what strikes me about it is that the inside of the building really kind of reflects what the outside of the building looks like. It's a, you know, this is an old hardware building.
It was, they called it the Amazon of the 1800s. So it's old, and there's still some like artifacts, we like to call them, around the building from the hardware companies, and the staircase is the original staircase. So we still have a lot of that old Milwaukee in the building when we also have this innovative space. So it's really cool.
So the reason we're talking right now is that in the coming week, you're working specifically with women entrepreneurs. First of all, what distinguishes, you know, a woman in a startup from a man in a startup?
Yeah, so a big thing is meeting Chris Abley and being able to work here was a crazy opportunity for me, because as a woman who came from before Bright Cellars, I was just at an office. I really didn't understand that I could do anything or be working to the potential that I am now. And he always was so, and he continues to be so encouraging of being inclusive of everyone and really giving everyone the tools to be as successful as they can be. So when I realized that existed, it was huge. I mean, just even coming to Bright Cellars, seeing that this exists in Milwaukee was crazy. And so all of my good girlfriends from high school and college would graduate and leave, never coming back to Milwaukee. Didn't see Milwaukee as a destination. I didn't either until I came here. And I think people are leaving, they don't know that it can be a destination. And it's got this insane potential. So my idea, and I think Ward 4 and the founders and Chris, we want women entrepreneurs to be successful and understand they have access to this. And we want to help them build their network.
It's interesting because I think we tend to think, or maybe just men tend to think, that there are so many more opportunities for women than there used to be. But if I get what you're saying correctly, there's still some kind of ingrained, I don't know whether it's lack of expectations or just it's still more difficult for women to connect with the startup world.
I agree. I think it's also a male-dominated space. I mean, often I'm the only woman in a group of people that I'm meeting with. So I think when Chris and Brian and Steve from Ward 4 or from CSA Partners asked me to work for them, I was like, whoa, I can do this. And I've continued to like show myself that I can. And I want other women to experience that, because I just don't think a lot of women know that they can. I didn't. And I now, my biggest passion is having people understand that they can.
Well, what was your, you know, what were you hoping to do before you got into this?
I was an ad PR student. I worked at the athletic department at UWM, and I loved it. I had amazing coworkers and a really cool boss. And then I just wanted to switch it up, and I thought, I'm in a cubicle. I like my job, but I think this just isn't really my place. So then when I came to Bright Cellars, I was like, startups, this is me now. Like, I can never go sit in an office again. So when I saw that, I was like, I really want to get into this. So my dream job was essentially explained to me in these guys asking me to work for them. It was really cool.
Well, it's also interesting because I think a lot of us who are not in the startup world think of startups as like aspiring to be something else. And I would imagine that there are a lot of startup companies that start as startups and then become more established businesses with more sort of conventional business space and doing things in a different way. But if I get what you're saying correctly, you and others sort of in the industry are attracted to startups because they are startups.
Yeah, I think there's something about that. When you do work for a startup, you have to care. You have to be so passionate or, you know, it's not going to do well. So I think something really unique about the startup industry is that everyone who is working for startups care so much about their jobs, and that's a really cool thing. And it's so awesome to be around. I mean, it's energizing. So I think that there's a passion behind a lot of individuals in this industry as well.
Is Ward 4 essentially a startup helping startups?
We could put it that way, yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot that we are developing still even, so it's cool.
Well, so talk about how the events of the next few days, and we're talking before they actually start, but talk about how the events of the week of women entrepreneurship, if you will, what's going to happen and how are they geared towards the kinds of things you were talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So Monday night, we're having the initial women's entrepreneurship night. We're having a panel of women from, I think, every walk of life. We're having even someone who started as a VP of sales at US Cellular, and now she's the president of Scanalytics, which is a startup down the hall. And then someone with marketing, the CEO of a marketing company. I mean, we have a lot of women to give different opinions and different insight, which I think is really important for us to hear. And then throughout the week, we're doing workshops. So skills like building a network. Maria Santa Caterina from Bright Sellers is actually holding that one. And then Michelle from Soch, the CEO of Soch, is having one on, she does marketing and branding and social media, and she's amazing. So we're all being able to sit in on this and learn the best ways to do certain things. We're also having free headshots for all women entrepreneurs, which will be a great thing, I mean, just professionally to build that. And we're hosting a self-defense class by an all woman-owned self-defense company.
Now, what does that have to do with entrepreneurship?
So, I mean, I have it where we're downtown in Milwaukee. This has been very prevalent in everyone's lives, I think, more recently. But walking out of the building, I never don't have my hand on my pepper spray, just because that's how I am always. And it's kind of something, and it's a scary thing for all women. I think it's very, very common. It's something you always have to be aware of as a woman. So it's, we want to make that confidence and instill some kind of power and help out women that really feel the same way, have the same experiences.
At the end of the week, what do you hope the lasting impact of this kind of, I don't want to say intense, but this, you know, sort of tightly grouped set of events, what do you hope the lasting impact is going to be for the people that you work with?
If I could have one thing, it would be for at least one person, one woman, to walk away from this thinking of herself as a person that can totally dominate at being a woman entrepreneur, because she can. So that's really important. I think it's cool to work for a group of people like Kristen, Brian, and Steve that are so encouraging of that. And if I can give that feeling, and if I can help, and if our network can help build that for women, that's the most important thing.
Kenzie Enright, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Kenzie Enright is Ward 4's community curator. You can find more information about Ward 4 and its Women's Entrepreneurship Week work at WUWM.com. We have time for some music from a recent Lake Effect studio session. If you were listening to popular music in the early and mid-90s, you'll probably recognize the voice of Glenn Phillips, if not his name. Phillips was the lead vocalist for the band Toad the Wet Sprocket, which had hits in the 90s such as All I Want, Walk on the Ocean, Fall Down, and others.
He still tours with the group from time to time, but also has a number of other musical projects and solo work, which brought him to Milwaukee last week. We'll feature our full interview with him in the coming weeks, but here is a new song he wrote with musician Laurie McKenna, a song called Nobody's Gonna Get Hurt.
Well, the earth is flat, grass don't grow. Northeastern winters hardly ever snow. There's no price to love, and there never was. Nobody's gonna get hurt. Yeah, the kids don't need a thing, and they always do the dishes. laundry does itself. And we are granted all our wishes. And if it's meant to be, it's easy. Nobody's gonna get hurt. The highway wasn't made for leaving. Whiskey wasn't made for regret. And the smoke in my lungs makes it easier to breathe. And broken hearts will always mend. I will always feel this way. I will never leave your side. I won't lose myself to fear or lose you to my pride. I will speak less often, but I will speak the truth. Nobody's gonna get hurt. The highway wasn't made for leaving. The whiskey wasn't made for regret. And the smoke in my lungs makes it easier. Broken hearts will always mend. Nobody, nobody, nobody's gonna get hurt. Nobody, nobody, nobody's gonna get. Lovers don't lie, and time is merciful. We're always gonna stay young and beautiful. And I will shoulder all the blame if we can't make this work. So nobody's gonna get hurt. Nobody's gonna get hurt. Highway wasn't made for leaving. Whiskey wasn't made for regret. And the smoke in my lungs makes it easier to breathe. And our best days haven't happened yet. And nobody, nobody, nobody's gonna get hurt. Nobody, no, nobody, nobody's gonna get hurt.
Glenn Phillips with Nobody's Gonna Get Hurt, a song co-written with Laurie McKenna. Phillips, best known for his band Toad the Wet Sprocket, was in Milwaukee last week for a concert at the Collectivo Back Room. We will feature a full interview with him in the days to come. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It is 11 o'clock.